And my job tonight is to talk on the book of Romans. I'll give you a broad overview and kind of a sketch on where we'll be going with the book through the weekend. Let me take a circuitous route in getting you there and call to your attention that when our Lord Jesus was ministering here on earth, he ministered to the Jews. And as he ministered to the Jews, he never intimated, except in the Great Commission, that he had plans for the ministry to go beyond the Jews. And there was nothing in his teaching to the 12 that would have led them to believe that they were to go out and start an institution or a movement or whatever you want to call it that was independent from and different from Israel. And so, if you'll put that in your mind, along with the thought that in the minds of the apostles, the time between the two Advents would have been relatively a short period of time. So at the ascension, they said to him in the book of Acts, "Will you at this time restore the nation to Israel?" And Jesus said, "It's not for you to know the time or the season. Just get on with the Great Commission." But all of them went out preaching the gospel, thinking that they would see the return of Christ in their lives. Now, so much was that a part of their thinking that when the Apostle Peter was about to die and he wrote his second epistle, he realized that he might not live to see the return of Christ and warned his readers against the scoffers who would say, "Where is the coming of the Lord? Why is he waiting?" Out in their wildest imagination would they have thought that 2,000 years would go, come and go between the two Advents. So in the minds of them, they logically thought that what they would do as they preached the gospel to every creature was if they were Jews, then they bring them into the right relationship with the God of Judaism. And if they were Gentiles, then they would bring them into the household of faith like they did in the Old Testament by making them part of the law. Then God brings to Christ this PhD in Judaism on the road to Damascus. And Paul goes out and begins as a minister to the Gentiles. And he says that it's possible for a Gentile to relate properly with Jesus Christ without going through the rites of Judaism. And gentlemen, there was just simply no way that they could put that together in their own minds. And they gathered together at the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15 to discuss this. And the miracle of miracles was that the Apostle Paul turned them around so that they all agreed that the Apostle Paul was right. But agreeing intellectually does not mean that you agree right here. And so Paul says that he had to review it with a little argument with Peter, as he discusses that in Galatians chapter 2. And all through his ministry, we have the Judaizers who followed along the Apostle Paul. And remember, the Judaizers were believers. These were men who believed that Jesus Christ was the way, the truth, and the life, that nobody comes to the Father but by him. But that, just like you would say, that it's also necessary to abstain from immorality and to be baptized if you're going to be a Christian, not as a requirement to become one, but as what something you do if you are one. So also they would say that circumcision and the keeping of the law is that which the believer does, not in order to become one, but one naturally would do if he's a follower of God. And so Paul was nettled by these Judaizers throughout his ministry because they could not agree emotionally with the conclusions of the Jerusalem Council. Because of this, he had quite a reputation throughout the churches. The churches were divided between the Gentiles and the Jews. His ministry was predominantly the Gentiles, and everybody else is the Jews. Now, in all probability, the church at Rome was founded by proselytes who came to Christ at Pentecost and brought the faith back among the Jews to Rome. But sprinkled into that community were the converts of the Apostle Paul. He makes reference to these in the last chapter as he talks, "Greet so-and-so and such-and-such." Now Paul is at the end of his third missionary journey. He's in Corinth. He's gathering together some money for the poor saints at Jerusalem. And by the way, one of the most extraordinary things in the Bible is here is a man who is fiercely opposed by the Jewish Christian community of Jerusalem. And yet on two separate occasions, he takes it upon himself to raise money to meet their needs. Now, it's one thing to give money to somebody who's unappreciative. It's an entirely different thing to give money to a guy who's your avowed antagonist. And that's exactly what he did. And as he was gathering himself together to do this, probably in the spring of either 58 or 59, we're not really sure, but on his way to Jerusalem, he pens this note at Corinth to the church at Rome. And in this, he sits down his matured thinking through years of distilling these great thoughts that he has argued and preached and taught throughout the churches. Now, Romans, as Gale says, is the queen of the epistles. One of the reasons is because it is his mature thinking. This is something that's not come at the beginning of his ministry, but at the end. Another reason is it's not a situational book, like, for example, Galatians is or the Corinthians are. Now, these are books that he wrote to because there were problems, and he's relating to these problems. There's no such tone in the book of Romans. But as he addresses himself to these people, he knows that there are two very important questions in their minds, and then one not quite as important, but he addresses it anyway. The number one question is, Paul, if you are correct in your thesis that a man does not have to embrace Judaism to have a correct relationship with Jesus Christ, then what do you do with the Old Testament law? And that is the subject of chapters 1 through 8. The second great question that hovered around his ministry was, if you are correct that the Gentiles are now incorporated into the household of faith apart from any reference to Judaism, then what happens to those inviolable promises that God made to the nation of Israel back in the Old Testament? And he answers that question in 9, 10, and 11. And McCurran is the one who's going to answer it for you. He's going to tell us exactly what that looked like. Then there was another question that was important to them that he addresses in chapter 13. Namely, the history of the Jews is a people set apart. They are a people who have God, not man, as king. Ideally structured, the nation is a theocracy. God sits on the throne. In Old Testament Israel, there was no legislature. There was no judiciary. Paul, how does the man or woman of God relate to the state? And that's the question he addresses in chapter 13. There's no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resists the power resists God. So that's what brought the book into existence. Let me make one other observation. As I was doing my study in the book of Romans, I asked myself, is there anything in the book of Romans that's unique to the book? That is, you don't find it elsewhere. Most of the material you'll find in the book of Romans, you'll find in a beautiful form, but you find it elsewhere in the Bible, with one exception I'd like to suggest to you, and namely the subject that he brings up in Romans 5 through 7. And that is the subject of sin. Now, gentlemen, in the Garden of Eden, Satan comes to Adam and Eve and tempts them. And so you've got an external force tempting men to do what they know is wrong. And they succumb. And all through the Bible, and particularly through the Gospels, sin is viewed in simply as a transgression of God's commands, the will of God. Sin is doing what you know is wrong. But the Apostle Paul takes it and puts an added dimension to it in these chapters, in which he says, in essence, that it's more than that. It is that for sure, but it is more than that. Sin is a force inside of, part of, independent from the individual that creates a war that goes on inside of an individual. The good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that I do. I find in the law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. There's this external force that's internal, and it fights with me. It is not me. For I delight after the law in the inner man, but I find another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. So this wrestling with this external force, I suggest to you that if you see it elsewhere in the Bible, you'll see it obliquely. It is there in Romans 5 through 7 that he spells it out. And it's my opinion, I have no license to be right on this, but I think that probably that's the reason why, at least one of the reasons why, those are such difficult chapters. Now, I'm going to turn this on and show you an overview, hopefully. Gentlemen, the slides you're about to see tonight, these overviews, I should say, were made back in the days when making overheads was an art form. So they are antiquated, but I think it'll serve the point. Now, I called it a Christian catechism. And those of you who come out of confessional churches know that one of the ways that they instruct is through the catechism. Now, again, remember, see, that we didn't have Bibles until around 500 years ago. And so the way they would instruct people is through catechetical instruction. That is, they would ask a question and then give an answer. And the people would memorize the questions and answers, which would give the basic doctrine of the faith. So if you were a Lutheran, it would be the Augsburg Confession. If you were Reformed, it would be the Heidelberg Catechism. If you were a Presbyterian, it would be the Westminster Confession. And all these, what we would call confessional churches, have these, and they are patterned after the Book of Romans, not only in terms of the question and answer, but also the logic and flow of the argument. So the Apostle Paul asks a question. What shall we say then? What advantage has the Jew? And then he answers that. And he raises another question and answers that. So it's in a catechetical form. Now, chapters 1 through 4, maybe 5, I think today probably I would structure it a little differently than I have it on here, but I would say that these first four chapters deal with the question of justification. How does an individual get right with God? The question that only the Christian religion answers, that no other religion in the world answers, not even Judaism, is how does a holy God take the likes of you and bring you to heaven without violating his justice and making heaven dirty? And the answer is Jesus Christ. And that is the subject of these chapters, 1 through 4. Then the next is, as God works in you to will and to do of his good pleasure, as he seeks to help make you the holy man that he has declared you to be in Jesus Christ, what does that look like? And that's chapters 5 through 8. Now, gentlemen, the church has been in agreement with 1 through 4 from the beginning. That is, if you're going to call yourself a Christian, you've got to pretty much agree with what Paul says in 1 through 4. There's very little wiggle room there. But chapters 5 through 8, now that's the stuff for which denominations are made. And that That has fractured the church into a jillion pieces. And so, bless his heart, Gale graciously gave those chapters to me. So I will fracture you into 1,000 pieces tomorrow when we're together, with the exception of chapter 8. And Skip is the cleanup man. He's going to straighten the whole thing out for us. I'll confuse you, and then he'll come and say, let me tell you what the whole thing looks like. Then, in 9 through 11, answers the question that McCurran will be covering for us. That is, the implications of it as it relates to the people of God in the Old Testament. And then the application in chapters 12 through 16. In chapter 12, the believer and the church. In chapter 13, the believer and the world. Chapter 14 through about the first third of chapter 15 is the believer and Christian liberties. And then from 15 on through 16 is his laying out his plans to see them en route to Spain, and some final greetings and salutations. Now, I'm going to go through this a little more in a moment, but let me stop and come up for air and see if there are any questions or observations you want to make. Justification. Yeah, you could say that 1 through 320 is sin, 320 through 5 is salvation, sanctification, selection, service. Then 5 through 8 is how does God work in you to will and to do of His good pleasure? God declares you to be holy. But if you're like I am, that's only a declaration. So how do you take the declaration and make it reality? That's the subject of 5 through 8. You can, but it's, I'm not sure it'd be worth it, but yes. Yeah, the question, when I say justification, I mean by that how does God remain consistent and make you His son? Yes. Yes. Well, let me suggest to you that an academic pursuit of a view of God is life and death. It's essential. Solomon says, as a man thinks, so is he. And you will act as you think. You are the product of your mind, your thoughts. They reveal who you really are. And so how you think is very, very important. That's why Gale said at the beginning that one of our tasks as men who seek God is to be men of the book, to understand His ways. And I don't know a better book to get baptized in than the book of Romans, to learn the ways of God. Yes, Brett. Why did he write it to Rome? Conjecture on my part. I think he probably wrote it because Rome, the seat of the capital, it was an influential church, and he was going to be there. And so it was kind of a letter to let him know who he was en route, anticipating his coming. Okay. I'm going to break them up. Romans chapter 1 through 3:20. The emphasis here is on man. Man the sinner. Now, I just simply took and broke the chapter down. Actually, the first main break is Paul's credentials. Verses 1 through 17. And 16, 17, the theme of the book. And then in 18 through 32, we have man's problem. This is an overview of the depravity of man. And you'll note that he begins by saying that God revealed himself, then man rejects God, and then God rejects man. And as God rejects man, you see that he rejects him in a series of what I would call progress and regression, steps downward, as he just spirals right into the abyss. And it's interesting to note, as you work your way through the material, that three times he says in the chapter, and God gave them up. God gave them up to what? He gave them up to what they wanted to do. And gentlemen, God's punishment of sin is letting you have your way. The one thing you want to pray is, God, never let me have my way. For God to give you what you want is to abandon you. And that comes through very, very clear in the opening chapter. Then he closes with a statement. Who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. And I scratched my head and I asked myself, how would they know? How can I go to the heathen and say, you can know the judgment of God? And that he answers for us in the second chapter. And in the first 16 verses, he gives us the principles of justice. And in verse 1, he gives you the heart of morality. It is the golden rule stated negatively. You're inexcusable when you become a hypocrite. And so tomorrow morning, when we get into that, you'll see how God just really nails it down as he lays out the principles by which God will judge all men. Now that is all people, Christian, non-Christian, Jew, Gentile, makes no difference. Every creed, every religion, every race is judged exactly the same way. And the judgment of God is absolutely fair and consistent, so much so, says Paul, as he asserts it in chapter 1, verse 32, that if an individual will think about it and be honest with himself, he will know he's worthy of judgment. It's irrefutable. Then he takes the template that he uses on the principles of justice and he applies it to the Jews. And in essence, he says, you are weighed in the balance and found wanting. And again, his logic is irrefutable. He says, in essence, number one, if you are a Jew and you don't keep the law, that circumcision will not help you. And if you are a Gentile and keep the law, you don't need circumcision. And then he talks about what is circumcision. What is the mark of the man of God? It is inward, of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter. Now, in chapter 3, he anticipates three questions that the Jews would logically, normally fire at him as a rebuttal to his condemning them in chapter 2. And of the three questions, two of them are pretty straightforward. But the second question is a little more complicated, And I can't remember who is going to give you that, but don't let him off the hook. Make him explain that second question, what he meant by it, and how he answers it, and how that answers the question. No doubt in my mind. Then, as he moves through chapter 3, he gives the verdict. And he does it by quoting the Old Testament. And he says that there are none righteous. No, not one. There are none that understand. There are none that seek God. There are none that fear God. Everybody has a problem. And so what he does is he gives us four conclusions as you come to the end of man's problem. The four conclusions are pretty straightforward. Sin is universal. The Old Testament confirms it. All the world is guilty. And your standard, irrespective of what it is, can't save you. It will only condemn you. Now, having discussed the problem of man, let's come up for air one more time and see if there are any questions or comments or observations. Sure. Sin is universal. The Old Testament confirms this. He quotes from the Old Testament again and again there in those verses. All the world is guilty. There are none righteous. There are no one that understands. They're categorical statements. And that your standard, irrespective of what your standard is, can never save you. It can only condemn you. And the reason is, you can't keep your own standard. Now, gentlemen, let me make this abundantly clear by way of application. And some of us have talked about this in the past, so I know this is review, but remember that nobody believes the truth is relative. Everybody believes truth is absolute. Everybody. The debate in the world today is not, is truth absolute or relative? The debate in the world today is, who gets to define truth? So you take me to whatever university, Duke, Stanford, Harvard, pick the most liberal you can find for me. And I'll tell you, they believe truth is absolute. You violate their code, they'll run you off. They will say to you, I don't agree that fornication is wrong, or homosexuality is wrong, or divorce is wrong. But cutting down trees, or abusing animals, or screwing up the environment, no, that's not being politically correct. Yeah, we'll nail you for those. See, the argument has always been, who gets to define it? Who gets to define truth? And God says, gentlemen, be of good cheer. You get to define it. Be my guest. The only caveat is this. You got to be consistent with whatever standards you got. So if you don't believe it's right to abuse animals, don't ever let me see you wearing a pair of leather shoes. And so forth. And he says, your standard, I don't care what standard it is, I don't care how you define truth, all it will do is condemn you. It will never absolve you. Any questions?
In the Downing Trial in Romans 1, it lists homosexuality and a bunch of stuff. It seems to me on observation that nobody gets all of those things.
Correct.
Everybody can dodge one or two and think he's okay.
Right.
So, could you explain that?
Yeah, see, I think what he's giving you is this kind of a generic picture of the human race. I don't think he's saying this is true of every individual. I think this is true of us as a people. Yes?
Well, there's a tension between having a reprobate mind as you cycle down through the engagement and then being held accountable that you knew they were wrong. seems like we've got kind of a tension there between the guy that says, how can you blame me for something that I didn't, that you took advantage of, that you darkened for me?
Yeah, good question, Stratton. What he's saying is that the reprobate mind is found, and you're not agreeing with me on what truth is. To call right what the conscience condemns is a sign of a reprobate mind. And he says in chapter 2, verse 15, that the law is written on the heart of the conscience, so that everybody knows intuitively what morality looks like. But God says that's okay. If you want to have a reprobate mind, I won't judge you for that. I'll just only judge you for the standard you end up with. Right. And that's the hypocrisy. That is the hypocrisy. It's wrong until I'm alone. It's like a guy I was talking to on campus a number of years ago, Stratton. We were arguing about morality. And I said, do you really think it's right to fornicate? And he said, for whom? Me or my kid's sister? See, he tells me it's wrong, but he enjoys doing it. He takes pleasure in it. No college student I have ever met wants to come home and find his mother in bed with another man. But he'll do it. Somebody else's mother, somebody else's sister, he'll do it. Should we go on? Okay, Christ is the theme of the next section. Now, gentlemen, if Romans is the queen of the epistles, and it is, I would suggest to you that these 11 verses right here are the heart of the book of Romans. 21 to 31. As a matter of fact, let me be so bold as to suggest to you that the understanding of these verses defines biblical literacy. That if you understand those verses, really understand them, that whatever else you don't know about the Bible, you are biblically literate. And conversely, I don't care how much of the rest of the Bible you understand, if you do not understand these verses, you cannot be called biblically literate. Now, in this section, he's going to throw around some words that we've heard kicked around a great deal, but you've got to understand them carefully if you're going to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. Words like grace, justification, righteousness, faith, propitiation, redemption, imputation. These are very, very key concepts, and how they play on each other are very, very important. In chapter 4, he illustrates it in the life of Abraham. Now, a couple of observations on this. Number one is that in the fourth chapter, what he does is he answers the question, how were people before Christ saved? And Abraham becomes his illustration. And Abraham believed God, and it was imputed to him for righteousness. Now, the second observation is that as he uses through the whole chapter, all 25 verses, Abraham is the illustration. He takes three verses, 7, 8, and 9, excuse me, 6, 7, and 8, and he talks about who? David. And one of the things you have to ask yourself as you go through this, why does he take that little parenthesis on King David? Starts with Abraham. Let's talk about David for a moment. It goes right back to Abraham again. Very, very important. We're not going to answer it tonight, but you just want to get that answered when you go through chapter 4. If your teacher doesn't answer it, grab him. All right? Now, chapter 5 is divided into two very logical and obvious sections. Verses 1 through 11 grapples with the question of why does God treat his friends like they are his enemies? And then he begins in chapter 5, verse 12 through 21, one of the most important and yet difficult portions of the book. And that is, wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. And here he gets into the imputed sin of Adam. And the ramifications of that are felt not only in the fifth chapter, through verse 21, but on into chapters 6, 7, and 8. Any questions or comments on that? All right. We'll hold that for tomorrow. The believer in sin, chapter 6. The believer in the law, chapter 7. The believer delivered by the Holy Spirit in chapter 8. He begins in chapter 6 by pointing out that the rulership of sin in the life of the believer is a contradiction of terms. What should we say? Should we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. You can't do that. Sin does not rule the life of a believer. But he talks about our position. We are dead to sin. Then in chapter 7, he talks about our experience. The good that I would, I do not, but the evil that I would not, that I do. And then in chapter 8, he talks about the power that God brings into our lives to help our experience begin to match our position. Now, there's two themes that run concurrently through Romans chapter 8. And that is the ministry of the Holy Spirit in the life of the believer and the importance of being assured of our salvation. The two are not entirely different. They are integrated perfectly. But they are different themes. The thesis of the Apostle Paul is that assurance is the product of a healthy relationship. If a man says, I'm not sure my wife loves me, you'd say to yourself, there's something wrong with the marriage. If a man says, I'm not sure I'm saved, you say to yourself, there's something wrong. Something terribly wrong in his relationship with God. Assurance is natural. It's healthy. It ought to be. Any questions on those? Yes, Skipper. Yeah. He prohibits sin in my life. Don't let it. Don't let it have dominion over you. Don't let it rule. Don't yield to it. But he reveals it in our lives. Yeah. Never become its friend. Never make peace with it. Okay, I know you're very tired. We're going to close this down real quick. We've already covered this, but I'll give you this one. What is my art form here? Actually, I wish I could draw that well. It's on my drawing. Past, we're freed from the penalty of sin. Present, we're being freed from the, the penalty. Freed, present, we're freed from the power of sin. And the future, we'll be freed from the presence of sin. So, the Holy Spirit working in our lives helps with decreased defeat and increased assurance.
Is it still 6, 7, and 8?
Yep. Still 6, 7, and 8. Thank you. Okay. Now, 9, 10, and 11. 9 deals with selection. Now remember, the context is Israel. He begins by saying, not all Israel is of Israel, neither because they are the seed of Abraham are they all children, but in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And then he gives that very powerful illustration of Jacob and Esau. For the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth, it was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger, as it is written, Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. Now, having lobbed that grenade into their lap, he raises 2 logical questions to the doctrine of election. Question number 1 is, it isn't fair. And question number 2 is, then how can God charge a guy who is non-elect when God elected him that way? How can you make him responsible? Now, how Paul answers that may or may not be satisfactory to you, depending on how Bill answers it when he preaches it. If it's not a satisfactory answer, it's because the Kieran hasn't done a good job. No, I'm just teasing you. Now, you may find his answers less than satisfying, but they are the answers he gives nonetheless. But before he closes the 9th chapter, he swings around and begins to talk about human responsibility. And so in chapter 10, you have Israel rejected. And here is the great responsibility chapter. And then, finally in chapter 11, with the illustration of the olive tree, the natural branch broken off and the wild olive branch being grafted in, he gives the illustration of Israel's ultimate acceptance. Now, twice in the chapter, chapter 11, he says that the casting away of the Jews was for the benefit of the Gentiles. Okay? And I studied the passage and I said to myself, that's an either or. Why couldn't it have been a both and? That's a win-lose. Why couldn't it have been a win-win? But he says one had to take place for the other to take place. Don't allow the churn off the hook until he answers that. Okay? Any questions on this? Yes. Let me do it with this one. God's plan is an amalgamation of his election and our obedience. So, below this line you have the individual, and above this line you have grandchildren, it's like in your family, kids are born into a Christian home, gives them a tremendous advantage, but doesn't guarantee them heaven. Now, in the New Testament, you don't have a corporate commitment. That's the reason you got 2,000 denominations in the United States. You couldn't have 2,000 nations in the Old Testament with God being committed to all of them. God only has an individual commitment. So the individual commitment runs throughout. But I put the Gentiles next to the Jews on the national level to show the emphasis. That is, in the Old Testament days, the emphasis of the program of God was with the Jews. Now, the emphasis of the program of God is with the Gentiles. And in the future, it'll be both. And how they come together in the millennium, we don't know. And what that means is it has an impact on the individuals. That is, that there are fewer Gentile believers in the Old Testament and fewer Jewish believers in the New Testament numerically. But Gentiles were saved in the Old and Jews are saved in the New. It's just the accent or emphasis of where the program of God rests. Yes? Jew and Gentile. Yeah. It's obvious, if you take the book of Revelation literally, it's obvious that not everybody in the millennium are saved. Because at the end of the 1,000 years, when Satan is led out of the bottomless pit, the world revolts. Yes?
The Jews in the Old Testament say the same way the Gentiles say in the New Testament, What you're saying is the Old Testament, there were more Jews numerically saved with their relationship with God personally.
Right.
The Gentiles say with their relationship personally.
Correct. Correct. Sure were. Yes. Right. And remember, as I began, Skip, I pointed out that that was in the thinking of the apostles when they started after Jesus' death, that they would bring the Gentiles to God the same way they are done through centuries. Proselytes. Okay, the hour is late. You guys have been on the go for a long, long time. Let's close it off, Gail. I'll turn it over to you and let you do what you want with it. No, 12 to 16 is the application, and I already covered that at the beginning, that the believer in the church, believer in the world. Yes. Sure. Right? Right.
And all of just yesterday, you know, kind of countless times I heard the word truth, and 15 years truth, I lost track because of the crowd. Do you think, what do you see happening? Is this, even people really want to know the truth? And then how do we, as believers, how do we unpack it? How do we know the process?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll be able to do it satisfactorily, but gentlemen, let me suggest to you that in our nation, we have a people who love justice and hate judgment. We've got one of the most litigious societies that ever have come down the pike. I mean, just look at me crosswise and I'll sue you. We want justice. But when was the last time you heard anybody preach on the judgment of God? Oh no, you can't be judgmental. But the truth of the matter is, It's an oxymoron. You can't have justice without judgment. So what we're saying in the nation is, I want my slice, but I don't want you to hold me accountable for it. I want society to protect me from the consequences of my behavior. Therefore, if you think I'm doing wrong, it's because I'm a victim, or because of my environment, I was raised on the wrong side of town, or I got a defect in my DNA. Anything but me. Anything but me. But woe to you if you cut in front of me on the freeway. And that's where we live. And we see it in the White House. I was truthful. Sort of. So. The argument of the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 2 is that nobody is capable of not judging. And the moment you judge, you're saying that there's a standard that applies not only to me, but to everybody else's besides. And when you do that, God says, checkmate. Steve? Yes. If God elects, why does He go through all this elaborate system of faith and grace and all those other things? Gentlemen, we say if things go bad, it's somebody else's fault. The market turned down. Or somebody did me in. Or it was the other guy's fault. If things go well, we say, aren't I great? Look at me. Made $1 million last year. Not too bad, huh? Pretty good, huh? So I lose $1 million, it's your fault. If I make $1 million, I'm great. Isn't that right? God says it's just the opposite. God says, if you go to hell, it's your own dumb fault. But if you get to go to heaven, it's because I did it. So the question is, whose mindset do you want to embrace? His or the world's? They both approach it the same way, just different conclusion. Now, the election is your anchor. Gentlemen, election will deliver you from heresy and all manner of mischief. Because the election strips you of your pride. When you face God after Romans chapter 9, you're naked. You have no ground for boasting. None. God didn't choose you because He saw you're going to do something great. He didn't think you were beautiful or clever or cute or nice. As a matter of fact, the illustration of how God views you is the illustration of Hosea and Gomer. You and I are the whore. All reason says that our union with Jesus Christ is nonsensical. Why would a holy God have anything to do with the likes of you and me? That's the value of the doctrine of election. God says, I'm going to hold you responsible. You'll never walk away from human accountability. Not now, not ever. Amen? Well, as we Christians say, good luck.